CliffCentral.com.
Hello, Mr. Fred Kumalo. What a pleasure to meet you properly. And you know what? Sit at this microphone. It's better. I like it more. Yeah, I'm biased towards this
one's
microphone.
A bit limp. It's strange.
Yeah. So, ladies and gentlemen, there is an author and a writer and a social commentator who's been around for a long time. I've been reading his columns for years in various newspapers. And he's one of those people who makes me laugh. He makes me smile. He makes me angry sometimes. He makes me sad sometimes, which is what the great writers are able to do. He's written many books before. Just to give you a quick look through, there are books like Seven Steps to Heaven, Touch My Blood, Bitches Brew. And now he's put out another book, which is bound to be controversial at very least. But I'm sure it's going to upset a lot of people and make other people very happy. Zuptas Must Fall. It's a provocative title, and Other Rants, that's what it's called. Fred Kumalo joins us this morning. What a pleasure to actually meet you finally in person, because I've been such a fan from a distance for the longest time. And look at you, you're sitting right in front of me.
Thank you.
How are you, Fred?
I'm good, thank you very much. I think the admiration is mutual.
Oh,
I think
you're just saying that because you're here.
No, I think in you I've seen a kindred spirit in that you see people like you and I, people who were dropped on their heads when they were small, you know, they find anything and everything hilarious, and they think everything is fair game for their game. So that's where we meet, I think. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you are one of those people, and I think this is probably true for only very few writers in South Africa who are able to combine an understanding of the general feeling in society with an opinion that sometimes is very unpopular. And you don't mind being unpopular, which is it's a hard thing to find people who are pleased to go against the current. This is something you've always done your whole life long, right?
Yeah, I think I thrive on that. As I said, people who are dropped on their heads just speak without thinking of the consequences. And
make themselves unemployable.
Yeah, that's what I do for a living. I piss off people. That's my bread and butter.
I want to get into your book in sure. a moment, but there's so much about your life that I want to talk about first. I mean, I've been reading your columns in various newspapers for years. Mm-hmm. Where did this writing spark start with you? Because for some people, it's just there, and the need to express themselves either in word or in deed or in, you know, in movies and these days in YouTube clips and in Facebook sure, rants sure, and all the sure. rest of it. It's just something that some people have from when they're very young. How did it all start with you?
With me, I was born a reader, even though my parents are not really educated. But my mother, who worked in the kitchens as a domestic worker, would bring stuff like Enid Blyton yeah. and The Famous Five and so on. So I started reading. English is not my home language, obviously. I'm Zulu speaking. But I was always, it's an aspirational thing, reading and writing in English. I can equally write well in Zulu as well.
You write for Isolezwe.
Isolezwe, that's correct, yeah. I started writing, producing stuff that I mistook for poems and short stories. And some of those actually found themselves in print in Staff Rider. I don't know if you are that old to remember that.
Sure.
there was a literary journal called the Staff Rider, where a lot of activist writers cut their writing teeth. And that's what happened with me. I started writing even before I got trained as a journalist. I trained at Natal Technikon, but I was published even before I got trained. And it has moved on beyond just journalism into creative writing and so on.
Now, you say your mom was a domestic worker and that
right.
she would bring you stuff to read.
That's right.
And that love for reading is, you know, just yesterday I was reading something about how if you take 10 and 11-year-olds and you figure out which 10 and 11-year-olds are literate and which 10 and 11-year-olds can read for pleasure, you will be able to project into the future how many of those people will be employed. And the ones who are not reading for pleasure at 10 or 11 years old are not going to be employed and are not going to be successful members of or contributing members to society down the line. It's an absolute, almost almost complete. It's not a one-to-one comparison, but it's an almost complete projection of what's going to happen.
Sure, because reading is not just about remembering your theorems from school and so on, but it stimulates your creativity, and it widens your vistas in terms of imagination and so on. So that's what I saw. I mean, I read James Hadley Chase about books set in the U.S., and I admired that guy, and that fires up your imagination, so it goes beyond the actual thing that you've just read, and you start creating your own stuff in your own head, and that's how it gets started.
It's almost like you've got two first languages, because you're so erudite, you're so able to express yourself and communicate in either Zulu or English. That is something that I think a lot of people envy in you, because a lot of people aren't able. Maybe they don't start reading young enough. Maybe they just don't have a grasp for language like you do. But it's something enviable, don't you think?
Yeah, it's something that one has to work hard on, because it's really difficult to get into a language that is not your own. I mean, we grew up during Bantu education days, where the people who were supposed to teach us English instruction, they themselves needed help. So you had to go the extra mile to be able to immerse yourself into reading and writing in that language. And of course, when I was in high school, I was instrumental in starting debating societies, and that always put me under pressure to be ahead of my class, you know, to say, okay, if I want to start a debate, then I must know the stuff that I'm going to be addressing. And I'll have to play the leadership role in running the debating society and identifying future talent or people who are going to be part of my debating society club, because those were competitions. We would move from one township to the next. We wanted to be champions. Right. You don't want, inarticulate people on your team. So you want to train them, to push them.
Yeah. We like to win.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But you also said earlier you find everything funny, and I love that. I love the idea that nothing is sacred, that everything should be a source of humor and inspiration.
Sure.
And in this country, we've got so much to laugh at, right?
Sure. I envy people like Trevor Noah, David Gao, because their job has been made so easy. You know, you don't have to imagine things. You know, you just have to tune into parliamentary TV
or watch Donald Trump.
Yeah, of course. You know, everything is so easy and in your face and so on. So you don't have to work that hard. You have to work very hard at trying to restrain yourself, which I have to struggle with every week, because there are some things that I want to write about, and I think maybe not this week.
you hold back.
There are moments like that where you think, okay, I'm going to be sued here.
Because you ask a bunch of questions in here. It doesn't look like you're holding back in your book.
Oh, no. In that book, I tried not to hold back. I tried to look at the question of the moment.
Listen to this. Yeah. I mean, this is so apt this morning. It's as if you finished this book and it was published yesterday.
Yes.
It's as if you wrote the last chapter yesterday. Listen to this question. Who are these Guptas and why are they so powerful? They're distributing cabinet posts like matrons handing out condoms at a brothel. And who do Americans think they are accusing Trevor Noah of stealing a joke from one of their other comedians? Is Sizakele Makumalo's spaza shop a national key point?
There's this question of, you know, people have been talking about the fire pool and all that. You see, we are a nation of very envious people. Just because the president can afford to have the spaza shop and the fire pool at our expense, then we envy him. Leave him alone. He worked hard for it.
He's been doing a lot of deals on Saturdays and Sundays while the rest of us are sitting at home with our family. I mean, the guy's prepared to work, you know?
Yeah.
Even if it's work with one particular family.
Yeah.
So what do you think of where we're at the moment? This whole mess with the finance minister and the Guptas selling out everywhere and coal deals with Eskom. And the president's son and the president, and what's going on?
Well, we all know what's going on. It's just the question is, where is it going to end? Where are we heading off as a nation? Maybe that's the question. What's going on, we know. People are robbing the country blind. We know that. But what are we going to do about it? That's the major, major question. Right now, when you raise your... when you raise your voice like Sipho Pityana did, thank God he is not in government, so he doesn't stand the risk of losing anything. Now look at Mr. Gordhan, Pravin Gordhan. He's finding himself in trouble because he tried to do the right thing, you know.
And even poor Bladen Zimande, who suddenly found a voice.
Oh yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, so you have to ask yourself, where is it going to end? And people have been saying, the president is about to resign, the president is about to be fired. You know, they say the average cat has got 9 lives. I think our president has got maybe 18 lives. No, maybe
you know, 27.
Maybe the number is too long to enumerate. It's 1,000,125,000. Listen carefully now.
800 and 700, listen properly, 769,820 and 70.
There we go. So that's how many lives he's got.
Yeah, the man has got so many lives. And he might just surprise a lot of us, and I see his reign through. I mean, people were saying he has to go before the term is finished. He might just surprise us and stay on.
He may even stay longer if projections are to be believed. You know, the only things that can stop the president from ending up in a very bad place are his own drive and determination to retain power, or to put a stooge in his place and to retain power from behind the curtains, and to set the country up so that it becomes a filter funnel for his interests.
Those are the intimations I'm getting as well. Because the man is indebted to so many people. Once he moves from his current office, people are of the opinion that the taps... and the tenders will have to be shut down. Mm. And what about the people that he still owes? Mm. So he must put a stooge in place who is going to make sure there's continuity, so that those people who are still owed by him get paid.
Get their turn to eat.
Yeah, you see, that's
our turn to eat.
Our turn to eat. So the snouts are still there in the trough.
Well, you know, it's interesting that... some people are saying, for example, that even with Blade suddenly about turn in terms of they've suddenly developed principles. Mm. When Blade was saying students must fall just a little while ago, now suddenly he's saying, well, this is called presidentialism, and there's factionalism that we suddenly have realized and accounted for.
Yeah.
And that this is maybe about his snout being removed from the trough, and that's why he's discovered principles.
Yeah, of course. It's all about self-interest at the end of the day. When you can see the writing on the wall, you might want to reconsider your levels and sense of loyalty to the powers that be. So maybe Blade can see things that we can't.
Yeah.
The writing is becoming more legible on the wall.
Now, when you write a book like this, you wrote a chapter called "How Google Made Me an Intellectual Eunuch." Now, so how did Google take your balls in the world of intellectualism? How did this happen?
Because, you see, I told you earlier, when I was in high school, even tertiary, I was a repository of information. I knew almost everything and anything, how to spell a certain word and so on and so on.
And this impressed girls?
Of course.
Sure.
And some people who needed to have letters of endearment sent to prospective girlfriends would pay me some money, you know.
And you'd help them.
I would craft the bloody thing so nicely, and I would get paid, you know, maybe a 20s of Peter Stuyvesant or something like that.
There we go.
So, And I was so popular, and some people thought I was too arrogant, but they still wanted my services. So, yeah, they worked with me. And then guess what? Google comes around.
And suddenly there's someone else who knows stuff.
Everyone knows anything now because Google it. It's there.
But we don't measure someone's intellectual capacity by how quickly they can Google something.
Yeah,
right?
Sure. Because they Google it now, 2 minutes later they've forgotten. Yeah. They can't even spell.
And surely real intelligence or even an intellect is marked by how much you want to know, not how much you do know.
Sure. The hunger for information and knowledge, that's the measure of a human being, I suppose.
And maybe that's why you started reading at an early age. Are you still such a voracious reader? Do you read nonstop?
Oh, yeah. Of course, as a writer, you have to know what's happening, what's cooking, who's writing what are the trends and so on. And it can be very frustrating and discouraging because right now I've got maybe 30 books that are locally produced by local writers that I still haven't read because the backlog is getting longer and longer and longer.
There's so much good stuff.
Exactly.
But there's also so much bad stuff. I mean, for example, with the profusion of really great writing and thanks to the internet, you can access writing from all over the world.
Sure,
you don't need
to
go to the library anymore.
Sure.
But there's also, if you pick up a daily newspaper, for example, you sometimes feel like you've been cheated and robbed.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You feel like I've just wasted a couple of minutes of my life reading some absolute horse shit that I could have avoided.
Yeah. It's very unfortunate. The industry is getting left behind by technology, I suppose. Some of the newspaper publishers are still thinking the old school and so on, and they are getting left behind. And there's the issue of training as well. We've got many universities that are training journalists now, but I always get shocked at the levels. I mean, you get people with masters in media studies and journalism. They've never touched the keyboard of a computer. They can't type properly. Just the basics. Let alone in terms of intellectual erudition and so on. That is the problem. They're just churning out degrees and degrees. But the actual craft of writing and investigation and so on is very shocking. And I've been interviewed in a situation like this. This person, I had launched a book about, the last book was 2011.
Mm-hmm.
This person comes to my office, I was still at the Sunday Times, and she thrusts a microphone into my face. Mr. Kumalo, tell us about your book.
Mm.
And that's the interview. That's
because
the interview.
She's done no preparation.
No.
She couldn't be bothered to even read the thing.
No, that's it. So I say the book is about this, and then what is the next question? No, just continue. See, that's how it's gone down. It's gone down.
It's become banal. You're right. Mm. Exactly. Now, let's try to be optimistic and not sound like intellectual snobs here.
We are.
Well, is it okay to be called a snob?
I don't mind.
You don't mind?
No, I've been called worse things. So,
what are the horrible things you've been called?
They are there in the book, like...
Are you sometimes called a clever black?
The clever black, the anti-Zulu, the reluctant Zulu, all those negative things.
You know, I thought about this. Now, I'm not a black man, so I can't ever put myself in this position. But if I were, and I were called a clever black, which is, I mean, it's deeply insulting. That's almost like saying, well, the stupid blacks are the default setting.
Yeah.
And we should aim for that.
Yes.
And the president said this, it maybe gave us insight into what he really thinks of the people of this country. But I find that kind of thing is too easily swept under the carpet by some. And even with this election that we've just had where, for example, a lot of ANC voters stayed at home because they're so dissatisfied with what's going on. Uh-huh. Many others might have voted for opposition parties. But it seems that they've come under a lot of scorn from the ANC. The ANC has nothing but scorn and hatred for black people who did not get up and go to the polls and vote for them. In other words, who were not their tools.
Yeah, when you try to do your work properly, to ask questions that need to be asked, you get things like, oh, you're trying to be white. Oh, you're anti-patriotic. Oh, you hate yourself. It is self-hate.
You've yeah. strayed too far from your tribe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And as if being part of the tribe is the be-all and end-all. You know, those people who were in the struggle, who struggled, who were in prison, who were on Robben Island and so on. The struggle was not the be-all and end-all. It was a means to an end. Mm. The means being the end that everyone was aspiring to is a normal society, a non-racial society, where a person will be respected regardless of their creed, color, or race. Now, we are very regressive. You must prove your credentials as a black man in order to be embraced and accepted and so on, which is very unfortunate. Very regressive.
Well, what do you think? Because it's a worldwide trend that almost this cult of kind of victimhood, and this is just my opinion. Please feel free to smash it into the ground if you think it's rubbish. But even in places like the U.S. at the moment, where you've got this Hillary Clinton Donald Trump fight coming up, which everybody's going to enjoy watching.
Sure, sure.
You have people they've created a hierarchy of victimhood, and suddenly someone like Caitlyn Jenner, who is a terrifically successful TV star, and a very rich once decathlete Olympian, is suddenly regarded as being a victim of society in some way, shape, or form, and even people who have the same condition that they feel that they're trapped in the wrong body, for example, that they're pushed down the pyramid, and she is the super victim. And the more victimized you are, the higher you are up on the chain, and the more you're allowed to say what you think.
Yeah.
Do you feel there's any merit in that?
Yeah, victimhood. You see, in the U.S. scenario, I thought you were going to move into the area of Black Lives Matter. I thought you were going that way.
What do you think of that? We can get into that just now.
Yeah, Black Lives Matter. It's a whole mindset, whole campaign, which is saying, you know what, these people are being attacked for who they are. Therefore, we should take cognizance of that reality. It's not as if they are aspiring for perpetual victimhood. Mm. They are saying, you know what, we want to be part of America, we want to be treated as ordinary Americans, but we are being singled out because of who we are.
And shot.
And shot and killed for who we are and so on. And it's been going on forever and ever and ever. Even in the new age, it's still continuing. But the issue of Jenner, it's a very sensitive case. In the beginning, it was proper to highlight the other, because it's a relatively new thing. Mm. The revolution of the genders is a relatively new thing, and it keeps evolving. Mm. Therefore, they have to be recognized for who they are as well. But when they sit on that pedestal of victimhood, that's when it becomes a problem, I think.
Some people are very good, though, in South Africa in turning that to their advantage. I mean, often the president has said that he's being victimized, that people don't like him to be successful, that people don't like him to be the traditional Zulu man that he is.
Yes. It's very unfortunate because he has distorted the whole notion of being a black person and a Zulu person, to be more direct. You remember during the rape case, for example, he was being questioned in court, and then they were just unpacking the whole thing of what happened next and what happened next and what happened next. And he says at some stage, we had reached a point of no return. As a Zulu man, I couldn't have left the woman to her own devices. It would have been culturally improper to leave a woman at that stage.
I remember that.
And he propounded that as if it's a Zulu norm or Zulu culture. I don't recognize that at all. It has never been the reality in Zulu society, unless he's creating his own own parameters of being of deciding who is Zulu and who is not Zulu.
Yeah, and what does that mean for a Zulu woman, for example? You know, does that mean that she at that point must abdicate all ability to decide for herself?
Yes, that's
she loses agency at the moment that that he decides as
yes,
a man.
Yes.
It's very complicated.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, but he chooses to complicate some of the things that are very, very easy and simple.
Yeah, but then why do they call you the reluctant Zulu? I mean, is that an insult as well?
yes, a Zulu in denial. Myself and, if I may mention his name,
yes.
In his absence, Mondi Makanya.
Oh.
We used to receive lots of letters at the Sunday Times that, what kind of Zulus are you? Even Gachap Telezi called us that. What
really?
What kind of Zulus are you? You are Zulus in denial. How can you say this about your chief? He's talking about himself in the third person. Oh. So yeah, you get called all these nasty epithets. A Zulu in denial, a reluctant Zulu.
You know, it's funny. Like when I think about how people feel about their identity, and identity politics is a real thing, whether we like it or not.
Sure.
When people observe their identity objectively from the outside, if you were an alien who looked at how people see themselves, and they would describe themselves as being Zulu, being male, being rich or poor, being maybe from Umlazi or Kwamashu or wherever else they're from. These are all important components of how people see themselves.
Yeah, sure.
But I don't know that there is anyone who I've ever voted for in any election, and I've changed my vote a lot over the last couple of years. There's no one who I've thought, well, that person I'm going to vote for because they represent me. Because I don't think any of them do. And yet, this is how politicians like to see us, is I will represent you. And they try to imbue in themselves a whole lot of characteristics that will attract you to them.
Yes.
I mean, if Zuma, he's our president. Mm-hmm. If Musi Maimane, who's the leader of the opposition, if they do something wrong, I don't feel let down as a male in South Africa or as someone who is South African by them. I just think, well, they've failed. I don't go, oh, well, they've pulled me down with them. Is that wrong?
It's just that we still are a very young nation. The whole notion of South Africanhood is still a long way off. There's no sense of being South African.
Yeah.
We still have to work.
Which is why we get stupid things like Braai Day.
Yeah.
Mean nothing to anybody.
Yeah. I mean, look at the Americans. It took them quite a while to reach a level of consensus, this is who we are as a nation. But still, there's still some exclusiveness to being American.
Well, look at Trump saying, for example,
the Mexicans,
these are not Americans. Meanwhile, it's only two generations ago his own people came to America.
Exactly.
South Africans, we've probably got a longer and more interesting history.
Yes.
We've got more to draw on.
Especially because of the cultural issue, the language issue as well. Because some of the battles that we've had across the racial divide in this country have been through misunderstanding. We didn't understand each other and we start shooting each other. 1976, 1961, Sharpeville. Issues like language, basic things, are still a divider. They form this delineation between the us and them kind of thing. So because of that still being there in place, achieving this nationhood at some level is still like a mirage. It's something that we're still chasing. We will get there at some stage because we are beginning to speak each other's languages better than before. There was a time when white people refused to learn African languages because it was considered improper and you couldn't have a conversation with a servant. It bred familiarity and that was not supposed to be encouraged. And
God forbid you should actually treat someone as a human.
Yeah.
but Fred, you bring up language and you bring up identity too. And is there such a thing as almost a Zulu superiority complex too, even if it's just, even if it's something that isn't spoken of loudly and proudly as perhaps white superiority used to be. You know, the idea that even if the president wasn't Zulu, like, yeah, there is, yeah, a thing about Zuluhood. Yeah. It's got a history. Yes. It's got a, it, the language is pervasive, mm-hmm, in South Africa. The stamp and the mark of Zulu history on this country is profound. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's unparalleled in terms of tribal history in South Africa. Mm-hmm. The borders defined currently by KwaZulu-Natal were defined 200 years ago already. Mm-hmm. And there were different factions within what it meant to be a Zulu. And in fact, the small family that branched out and became the royal family of the Zulus did it by imperialism, yeah, if nothing else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is there a kind of Zulu superiority complex?
I think you've answered your question in the process of asking this question.
Sorry for so long, but there is such a thing.
You see, it has to do largely with the fact that Zulu people were the last African people standing to the imperialists, the British imperialists.
Mm.
The last battle.
The trial.
That was the major thing, and it became a defining moment in South African history in general, because the Zulus stood up and they won against the British, who were armed.
San Luan.
Of course, the British came back to Rogers Rift, and they decided to decimate the Zulu kingdom once and for all. But the vestiges of power and so on were still there. The Zulus, when they speak about the San Luan, they get very emotional because of that. So the question about Zulu superiority, it's I could say it's Zulu pride.
I like that more.
We say, even though we lost at Rock's Drift, we lost our kingdoms, we had many chiefs imposed upon us, we still have that thing that drove us to stand up to these mighty Brits and so on. So it's there in our language. If you read this book, I give you at least 20 synonyms for beating up a person.
Why are we violent? Is that what you're trying to say? Are we violent people?
No, we are defensive people.
But there is a thing also about men in South Africa, and this is something white and black men have in common, is that we just have not yet come to grips with how we treat women.
Oh, yeah.
We still have a long way to go.
Yeah.
Men in South Africa are way behind the curve in terms of controlling our own emotions, of figuring out how we deal with our own insecurities.
Yeah.
This is common, and this is also something you point out in your book.
Yeah. I write about that a lot in this book, and I've done that in my columns, which invited all these criticisms of me being a half Zulu, reluctant Zulu. Yeah. How can a Zulu person say we are being violent? And so
that you just raised the term they use is house nigger sometimes, right? Mm. Which is it's pejorative in the most horrible way, because it means it was like that character Samuel L. Jackson played in Django.
Django and
that's a house nigger. He's the guy who thinks he's better than the other blacks.
Yes.
Isn't it funny that there's a word, there are a whole lot of terms for black people who other black people don't like. But for a white man who wants to spend time with black people, there are so many fewer of these terms, right? You know what I mean?
It's almost like
there's a special place in hell for the black man who's but the white guy who doesn't is not as much hated by society. Isn't that a strange thing?
No, but you have are we allowed to use the
K word? Any word you like. You can get away with it. I'm not going to. I won't try, but you can.
You have a kafir booty.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true. I forgot about that one. Okay.
Yeah.
There are some.
Yeah.
Turns out there are a few. Yeah, I suppose so.
A yod lover or something like that.
A jew lover, yeah, which is also supposedly something that is hateful.
You can't
possibly like black people and Jews.
Yes.
And be a good white. Okay.
Yeah.
No, point proven. How about this story that's going on in the Pretoria girls' school at the moment, where where black girls are being told their hair is not relaxed enough, or, I mean, this is a nonsense thing.
You know,
black women and their hair, you don't want to get into.
My children go to one of these private schools, and they've told me so many of these stories about hair at their school. You can't have these kind of braids. They are not ladylike. They are not elegant enough. And this is a white woman telling...
Who are these people?
Yeah, telling my children that their hair is not relaxed enough. She doesn't understand the complications that you...
you know, every time that I've...
So hair is a very sensitive thing. Yeah,
You can't win as a man if you enter a conversation, particularly over black women's hair, with anyone. You will always be torn down.
Yeah.
And rightly so.
Yeah.
But isn't it the most bizarre thing in the world that somebody has a problem with the way my hair grows out of my skull?
Yeah.
You take issue with that. Why? This is how it grows. What do you want... What must happen?
Yeah,
because
this is how it grows.
I have expectations of how your hair must grow.
But I don't care about your expectations because I'm not you. I'm not a white person. And stop trying to make me look like a white girl.
And there is an expectation, but there's also reality. And your expectations may play no role in reality. Yeah.
So what do you tell your children? I mean, what do parents tell their children when they deal with these things in these schools?
No, just... Well, my wife deals with that because she is dealing with it from a woman's perspective. I'm not a woman. I can't pretend. So
good first step.
They use a lot of gels and stuff that I don't use. Yeah. So I don't know what this gel does to you. So who am I to make an informed comment on that, you see?
Yeah.
So let me leave them alone to it. So that's what happens.
But this is an example of the kind of stuff that's really holding us back. In terms of, it's an unnecessary distraction that's built into the system to make people feel like the other.
Yeah.
Instead of just, you have your hair, do whatever you want with your hair. This is not the most important reason for you to be at school.
Yeah.
And we had people, listen, if I look at the kind of hair, the stuff I'd put in my hair when I was at school, I looked like a moron. but luckily, if it was short, they left me alone. It's the least important thing about you when you're at school, what kind of hairstyle you have.
Yeah.
I don't understand this. Is there a thing equally with black men's hair as there is with black women's hair, or is it not as big a deal?
It's not. It is there, but it's not as big as it is in the woman's space. For example, we don't do weaves. Men do not do weaves. That's another thing.
Yeah.
I've had a guy being torn down by women about the weave situation. Why are you trying to be a white? Why are you wearing white people's hair? And this
Huma Sekela.
who will not take a picture with you if you have that evil weave.
God forbid you don't have, like... Natural. If you're not natural, Hugh doesn't want a picture with you.
Yeah. So yeah, you don't even understand where the weave comes from. It's a long history, you know. It's a long history, and why they do it, and what it does to their hair, and so on. So there are debates, there are battles you don't even want to get into.
Right.
You know. Yeah.
All right, there's so many words on this cover. Just the cover of your book is enough to get people's attention. Let's just look at this. So we've covered the Guptas slightly. We don't need to go into that anymore. Donald Trump, there it is. Tell me about Donald Trump.
What?
I mean, this guy could. He could. Some people are saying he actually could win this U.S. election. What kind of a world will we go to?
That is the scary thought. The fact that the man has gone this far in the race should tell you a lot about the American headspace, you know? this is the guy who has said some nasty things about women of all color. He has said some shocking things about Mexicans and the fact that they must go back home, and he's going to build a wall for which they are going to pay.
Yeah.
He has well, yes, said many, many other things about black people in general and about Obama himself in particular. So he is a guy who just shoots. Who just shoots from the lip without thinking.
Was definitely dropped on his head.
Oh yeah. No doubt about that. So and it's scary that this guy could become the president of the biggest and most powerful country in the world. And this country has been involved in so many, many wars. When they had people of a milder disposition than him, how much more with him being who he is, being in charge of, he's got his finger on the nuclear on the nuclear bomb.
I mean, who in the universe is excited by this sentence? Here are the nuclear codes, Mr. Trump. Sure. I mean, who in the world wants that sentence to be said?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's scary that it's a real possibility that he just might become the next president of the U.S.
Terrifying. Mm. What about Beyonce? I mean, she just cleaned up at the VMAs last night. Beyonce got every award there except, I think, for two of them.
Sure.
And yeah, she arrived...
Wow. Best male vocal.
Wow. I think she probably got that as well. I mean, she really did clean up. So tell me about Beyonce, why she's become such a cultural icon for people too. What does she represent? Because it's not even the real Beyonce that we're talking about. It's this made-up Beyonce that some people
have.
It's
this crafted persona.
Yeah, I was about to get
that. She's worked on this persona for a long time.
She is so good at marketing. She is so good at positioning herself in terms of what is fashionable at that time. Look at what she did with the Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie essay on feminism.
Right.
Yeah. So the success of that book by Chimamanda can be traced to Beyonce, and Beyonce's success as well can be traced to. So the whole thing is mutually mm-hmm. beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
She looked at what the debate was all about. Feminism from a black African woman's perspective, and she latched onto that, and it worked wonders for her. And then there was the lemonade thing, and then she is just good at packaging herself, and it's all about that, basically. Yes, she's a good artist, she sings very well, she's got a stage presence, she's electric on stage and so on, but it's all about packaging. There are many, many women and singers in the world who sing better than her, but they haven't mastered the whole thing of packaging.
And she's got critical mass. I mean, if Beyonce says something, there are thousands and thousands, if not millions and millions of women all over the world who will carbon copy exactly what she said into their own lives.
Which is
a tremendously powerful place. Some people would say she's more powerful than someone who really does have the credentials in terms of political and intellectual pursuit, like Michelle Obama, for example. I mean, she almost comes second to Michelle. She's the real first lady of America, even though Michelle is a very impressive woman on her own.
But isn't that a dangerous thing, though, to quote unquote worship someone that much? That doesn't sit well with me.
People have mutilated. Women have mutilated their bodies to look like her. They've done butt augmentation because they saw her butt and she's fashionable, and that they thought this is the way to go. And I was reading a month ago in the Sunday Times, women were saying, I'm spending so much money on butt augmentation because I was so impressed, I was so touched by Beyonce and so on. You know,
that's crazy.
That is crazy.
What would you do if one of your daughters came home and said they're going to get butt implants so they can look like Beyonce or a Kardashian?
Do I have any power?
That's the question, right? Because maybe you don't. Maybe you shouldn't be the one who's commenting. You abdicate this responsibility to your wife.
Of course.
And what do you think she would say?
She would intervene. She can intervene. You think I'm opinionated? Then you must meet my wife.
She's even worse. We're talking to Fred Khumalo. His book is called Zupta's Must Fall. Do I have to mention the hashtag at the front?
Yeah, sure.
There's so many books coming out now with hashtag as the title.
It's all about marketing, my brother.
I'm onto it. I think it's clever. What is the black tax for those people who don't already know?
Black tax. I'll make an example. I'm the eldest in our family of eight. The minute I finished matric, I had to go to either find a job so that I could support my parents and my siblings, my younger siblings. Or, and I insisted, I put my foot down. My mother said, no, you are going to university because I had done so well at matric. And they raised money, I went to university and graduated. I had no notion of, well, I wanted to do a senior degree, but they said, no, you can't. You have to support the rest. So that is basically what black tax is about, paying right. back, plowing back to your family. But it doesn't end within your nuclear family. It extends to the extended family, whereby you have to pay their school fees. A person is getting married. They need some money. They come to you. That is the essence of black tax.
So it's essentially that you have to pay it forward to your whole family because you can't go forward on your own. You don't just leave them behind.
Oh, yes, of course. You know,
And that obviously means that you're supporting sometimes a whole community.
Yes, of course.
And your success is dependent on them, but they're also dependent on you.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. It can work wonderfully in some settings. Let's say you've finished your degree, you are working, and you support the rest. And then they proceed as well. They get to university, and they start working as well. So because you didn't finish your senior degree, and you need some money to do this or that, they will remember that Big Brother did this for us, so we must support him. Maybe he wants to buy a new house, wants to extend his house, or maybe he wants to send one of his children to university, but he doesn't have money. Then they put their shoulder to the wheel. So it becomes a self-perpetuating kind of setup where people help each other. Yeah,
right.
But sometimes it doesn't work as well as like that because some people get very selfish. They say, "I'm on my own now." He moves from maybe your home is in KZN. He moves to Joburg. He cuts ties with the rest of the family. He or she starts his own life here in Johannesburg, and that's the end of it.
And does stupid things like voting for the EFF or the DA, and abandoning his family in a KZN. municipality run by the IFP. Now, there are a lot of personalities in South Africa at the moment. I mean, people can't help themselves when they talk about someone like Julius to ask everyone else's opinion on Julius and then to give theirs. You talk about Julius quite a lot in your book. You talk about Baleka. You talk about the president.
Yeah, yes.
We've got a cast of characters for this soap opera that you couldn't beat.
Wow. No,
great,
you can't.
Right?
You can't. Yeah. Julius, you see, when I came in here, you and I were dropped on our heads when we were small. You know, but he was dropped from a very high place, you know. His fall was so intense, you know.
What are you trying to say? Are you saying what a lot of people say, that he's not up for the job?
You know what? I used to have my Julius is good as long as he's in the opposition, because we needed a voice that would be vociferous, that would be very high against what was happening in the name of the country. But I can't imagine that man with all his energy and so on. I can't imagine him in a seat of power. Because in that seat, in that office, you have to think before you act or before you speak. Sometimes you have to say, you know what, let me allow my ministers to run with the ball now. Let me sit back a bit. I don't see Julius having that in himself to say, okay, let me allow the other comrades. We've seen him.
So in other words, your worries about Donald Trump are similar to your worries about Julius.
Yes, loose cannon.
Yes.
Thankfully, we don't have a nuclear bomb in South Africa, so so
that we know of. Although the Russians may help us to build one, for all we know. Wow, sure. Fred, this is a terrific book. It's called Zuptas Must Fall and Other Rants by Fred Khumalo. I think we've got to get you back in here regularly to talk to us. You inspire us with lots of ideas, lots of humor, and the book is an absolute must-buy for Christmas.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I can tell. Mubs, you're going to read this, right?
Absolutely.
For sure.
It promises insight, so I'm all over it.
Yeah. Bak Mabul.
Yeah.
Tell me.
That's one of the synonyms for pitching up.
Mm.
There are so many of them.
Speaking in tongues. I love this.
Yeah.
There is so much good stuff in here. Did you have to do a lot of research? Because I see you quote a lot of people. You refer to articles from newspapers from 5, 6 years ago.
I had to pull some of the stuff that I had written back then and polish it and update it for this present moment. And I worked with some good editors who were pushing me to say, but why don't you update this? You know? Yeah.
How long did it take you to put the book together?
Not a long time. One year. Wow. Just little.
Yeah, well, you're such a prolific writer, and you write so much every week. How do you do this? Do you sit at home and do it? Do you have an office somewhere? Where's the best place for you to write? Wherever inspiration strikes?
I write from home.
Okay.
But I'm notorious among my friends. We could be sitting and drinking, and thank God we have got cell phones now where you can type notes.
Yes.
I can type notes as if I'm checking my messages. I'm typing an opening paragraph for a story, for example, or I'm eavesdropping and recording what you guys are saying.
Yes.
For a character that I've created and so on. Because I write both fiction and non-fiction.
So life is your inspiration?
Oh yes, most definitely.
And your office is everywhere you go?
Oh yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Fred, thank you so much for coming to see us. It's an absolute pleasure to meet you in person.
For
the longest time, I have been a fan, and I never miss anything that I find with the name Fred Khumalo attached to it. The book Zuptas Must Fall is available at good bookstores now. Stocking stuffer for Christmas. And if you don't want to be thinking about Christmas yet, then just buy it for fun, because it'll give you a few months a head start on everyone else. And you can read about all the things that in South Africa we are already discussing, except you have the wit and the erudition of Mr. Fred Khumalo to guide you through it. And hopefully you come out much smarter on the other side. Thank you so much for coming to see us, Fred. Pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much, Gareth. CliffCentral.com.